on this week's program, a conversation with Osmo Venska. He's in town to conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Delaware Theatre Company as they stage the premiere of A Murder, A Mystery, and A Marriage. The new musical is an adaptation of a Mark Twain short story. In our regular exploration of the Culture Files section at gophila.com, Susan Lewis visits historic Yellow Springs. And we'll speak with James Undercoffler, the new president and CEO of the Philadelphia Orchestra. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Osmo Venska is emerging as one of America's premier conductors. The Minnesota Orchestra music director began his career as a clarinetist. His first conducting job was in 1985 in his native Finland, when he was appointed principal guest conductor of the Lahti Symphony, a regional orchestra in a town of less than 100,000 people, an hour north of Helsinki. He became Lahti's principal conductor in 1988, and in the following years transformed the ensemble from a good local group into an international powerhouse. He was chief conductor of the BBC Scottish Symphony from 1995 to 2002 and landed the Minnesota job in 2003. These days he's also much in demand as a guest conductor and has performed with all of this country's major orchestras, as well as the Berlin Philharmonic, Amsterdam's Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, the Leipzig Gewandhaus, and the Orchestra Nationale de France. A soft-spoken, unassuming man in his mid-50s, his quietly thoughtful offstage persona radically transforms into animated music-making when he steps onto the podium. Osmo Venska is conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra in a series of performances featuring Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini with pianist Stephen Hoff, and two works by Finnish composers, Eno Johanni Rautavaara's Cantus Arcticus and the Symphony No. 6 of John Sibelius. I met with Maestro Venska backstage at the Kimmel Center on Thursday and first asked him how his approach to guest conducting differs from leading an orchestra as music director.
I think that I have to do the same job what I am doing with my own orchestra too. I don't see it very different. And of course, to come, for example, to conduct a Philadelphia orchestra, which has a great tradition and fame, you need to know what you are going to ask, and you need to know what you are going to tell them, because they have seen everybody. But I think that's just a basic thing. Every program needs to be practiced. Every fine result in a concert needs a preparation, and that's why I'm here. I have to take care that we can put the ensemble together and that everybody are playing the same piece, I mean, same interpretation. That's my job, to take care that all the rhythms, all the colors, all the similar kind of dynamics, they are basic things.
But in the case of the program that you're performing this week, you could claim a greater degree of, if not knowledge, certainly ownership of at least two of the composer's works, Rautavaara and Sibelius. Does that give you a greater leeway, do you think, in how you interpret?
I think that they need me more. they cannot do things without me, and that gives me some kind of a little bit more space on the stage. If I go to conduct, for example, here Beethoven or Tchaikovsky pieces, what they know so well, that might be more difficult because, first of all, I need to win the players on my side. Sometimes they don't like at all what I'm doing, but to give some kind of motivation to do on this way, and if they feel that there is some kind of natural connection to the music, then they will do it. But it's a bigger risk to do something very familiar than unfamiliar things.
I want to talk to you about your work at Lahti, a small town in Finland. You've produced some incredible music from an orchestra that exists in, let's to not put too fine a point on it, not one of the world's great cities. They were pretty good before you got there. They're now astonishingly good. Two-part question. One, how did you do it? And two, I'm guessing that I'm not the first person to ask that question. Have orchestras from around the world in similar situations come to you and said, you know, is there a magic bullet or a magic wand we need to use?
I think there is not any magical things. It is just based for the very, very hard working. And I think that if there is an orchestra which could play every single concert a little bit better than the previous one, always a little bit better, and if the attitude is right, so that it should be humble enough to start again after the very good concert. So we have to be ready to do again those basic things, put things together and play as a better ensemble, so that the next concert is even better. Again, it's much more inside of one's head, the whole thing. Of course, there must be chemistry between the players and the conductor. But if everybody agree to work very hard and really take, if needed, 21 times something again, then the result is going to be good. But of course, then the conductor should have a great vision about how he would like to get this music. But as far as the conductor can tell them to play this louder or softer, put the ensemble together to find out which group are a little bit too fast, which are a little bit too slow, and which are the things in music what we need to take care more and then put others down. It's those simple things. If the conductor can do his job and the players accept that job and are ready to do every day this kind of hard-working things, then the orchestra is getting better.
But you talk about humility. It's much easier to ask a group of musicians who are not from London or New York or even Minnesota to be humble, leave their ego at the door, so to speak, accept that they have to go back to the drawing board every time and try and improve it. How did you approach that when you went to a much more well-established orchestra? Mm-hmm. And did you take that attitude with you?
Well, I tried to do my things always in the same way. But you are right. There has been some troubles with, sometimes those very famous orchestras, they don't want to work again. They have done it and they might be tired or whatever is the reason, but they don't want to be again like in school, just trying to do those things. And then the idea is that just be it better and it will be fine in the concert. Okay, sometimes, but it's a huge risk. And if I am thinking about the people who buy their tickets and they would like to come and listen to us, then we must be prepared. Why should they come if we are playing like a bad quality? And that's the risk for me if we don't rehearse and prepare enough. So some orchestras have allowed me to do things, and some they have refused, and then there has been bad feelings on the stage during the rehearsal. But I don't think it too much. I have my way to conduct the orchestra, to rehearse, and I know that if I can do my job, usually the concert is good enough, and I don't need to change myself like just to smile to some orchestras because they are so good. I tell you, when I went first time to Cleveland, and we had to fix in first 10 minutes some woodwind intonation things, and later on, now I have been there many times, and the musicians told me later on that was the point why they wanted to re-invite me, because so often conductors go first time to Cleveland and they are just telling how great they are and it sounds wonderful. And the musicians, they know that it's not so wonderful first time and they want to do it better. So they need someone who is pointing out, okay, play this better and this corner better and change this intonation, whatever, rhythm. But I think that it's good for the orchestra if someone would like to work with them and if they accept that.
Osmo Venska, he conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in a program featuring works by Rachmaninoff, Rautavaara and Sibelius. Remaining performances take place tonight at 8, tomorrow afternoon at 2, and on Tuesday evening at 8 at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Mark Twain is one of the most celebrated early American writers. In his day, he gained international status with his humorous and insightful novels, short stories, commentaries, and lectures. The same year that Twain started writing his classic, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, he penned a short story called A Murder, A Mystery, and a Marriage. Unlike Huck Finn, however, the short work has remained relatively unknown and was in fact unpublished until 5 years ago. Now in collaboration with the Roundhouse Theatre in Bethesda, Maryland, the Delaware Theatre Company in Wilmington is staging a musical version of this Twain melodrama. WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer has the story.
Mark Twain thought he had a surefire plan. In 1876, he came up with the idea of organizing a writing competition that would include 9 other prominent writers. They'd establish a basic plot skeleton, a marriage and a hanging taking place on the same day, and then proceed to flesh out their own versions of the story. The writings would eventually be printed as a series in the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Twain believed it would be wildly popular with the readers and also profitable for the authors. Supposedly, Twain was so excited about the scheme that he wrote his version, called A Murder, A Mystery, and a Marriage, in 2 days. Unfortunately, Twain was unable to get other people excited about the project, although he kept trying for nearly 20 years. In 2001, 125 years later, the writing competition that Twain envisioned was finally realized. A public library in Buffalo, New York, sponsored a literary competition that employed the basic premise Twain had in mind. That same year, Twain's short story was printed in The Atlantic and subsequently published in book form. About 2.5 years ago, Philadelphia-based theater director Aaron Posner came across the newly released book as he was searching for works to adapt for the stage.
It just struck me as having a kind of very quintessential American quality, a real big heart, a lot of fun possibilities to this story. And then at the same time, I was out at the Oregon Country Fair, which is, I'm from Oregon, and I heard this fabulous jug band playing real sort of old-time American music, and all of a sudden it had one of those little moments you have sometimes. I went, this story, that kind of music, those belong together. This sweet, small story could actually be a fabulous musical. And I went home and started writing that day.
One, two, ready, hey.
Stories are like diamonds, or so the poets say. They're beautiful and bright and useful too. We see ourselves reflected in each passing and each face. And who cares if they're all a lie as long as they are true?
Dan Manning as Clem, the narrator in the opening song of A Murder, A Mystery, and a Marriage, a Mark Twain musical melodrama. Staged with a set design resembling a big wooden barn, the tale takes place in 19th century rural Missouri. While farmer John Gray tries to prevent his daughter Mary from marrying a poor store clerk, a charismatic stranger shows up in town. Tragedy strikes in the small community as the unknown visitor's arrival leads to a mysterious murder. The result is an eventful day that involves both a hanging and a marriage. Although it might sound like a play that has some potentially dark themes, it's actually a lighthearted piece. This is reflected in the melodic bluegrass and folk-style music that's woven into the show. Philadelphia actor and sound designer James Sugg composed the music for the melodrama. He explains that the competition didn't involve a lot of conscious thought about or research into folk or bluegrass. Rather, his writing mainly centered around the 3 instruments he plays, guitar, piano, and accordion.
The flavors kind of emerged from each of the instruments. The bluegrass stuff, when I took from the lyrics and played on guitar, the style kind of came easily. Likewise, when I was writing songs for the lovers, I went to the piano, and it had a more soft, contemporary, country, more pop, slightly feel, which I wanted for the younger love interest characters. We have a character, the stranger, who is this kind of pan-European shenanigan mountebank. So the accordion fit him like a glove.
That is certain, so it is certain that we must part.
The piano and accordion pieces performed here by James Sugg are more or less conventional compositions. The singers and musicians perform the songs note for note, as indicated by the score. But James Sugg points out that not all of the music in the show lends itself to such detailed instruction.
part of the band and part of the music is this folk tradition. And when you play folk songs, you don't write out every note for the banjo to pick. So some of our scores are just going to be C, G, A7, G. You know, like, they're going to be chord charts. But there's a certain amount of looseness which I think is right for this kind of style.
A certain amount of looseness is not uncommon when premiering plays. A new show's first rehearsal process usually involves many cuts, additions, and rewrites. Few things are set in stone. Scott Greer, who plays the stranger in this newly staged production, has been involved with A Murder, A Mystery, and A Marriage since it was first workshopped at the Arden Theater about a year and a half ago.
The story has gotten, the characters have gotten a lot stronger and more human and have evolved into sort of sweeter, more genuine people as opposed to sort of funny, dopey rubes. So that has been a major evolution in the script. It's been a great experience to kind of watch that come together.
The driving force behind this process of bringing A Murder, A Mystery, and A Marriage to the stage is Aaron Posner. Not only is he the writer of the musical's book and lyrics, he also directs the show.
My adaptation is really an extension of my directing, so I connect them both together. So this is not about, I'm going to be the playwright and write this play, but rather, here's a fabulous story that I want to tell, and I think I have ways that it can sort of work on stage. And the adaptation and the direction are sort of seamlessly interlocked, one hopes. That's the goal, anyway.
Although not word for word, Posner's adaptation relies heavily on the basic plot that Mark Twain developed 130 years ago. Twain probably didn't envision a musical spinning off the competition he tried to organize, but it's hard not to believe that Aaron Posner's version of the story isn't in keeping with the creative spirit that Twain was trying to foster. Posner jokes that all he needs to do now is get 9 other people to write musicals with the same basic premise.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Delaware Theatre Company's A Murder, A Mystery, and A Marriage opens this evening and runs through May 14th. Now in our regular dip into the culture file section at gophila.com, Susan Lewis visits historic Yellow Springs.
What do the Lenape Native Americans, George Washington, Swedish Nightingale singer Jenny Lind, Pennsylvania Impressionist painter Daniel Garber, and actor Steve McQueen have in common? They lived very different lives at very different times, but all were drawn at one time or another to a meadow of wetlands in the Pennsylvania countryside. So today, when you pull up to the intersection of Yellow Springs and Art School Roads, you can conjure the ghosts of communities of people that have called this place home, or a home away from home. This is historic Yellow Springs. Yellow Springs was put on the map as early as 1722. The idea that water could cure was part of both Native American and European traditions. As English, Welsh, Irish, and Germans settled the land in Chester County, word spread about waters that were magical, healing, and very yellow.
My daughter, who's about 2 years old, calls it the icky water, which it does look pretty icky, but this is where the name Yellow Springs came from.
Rob Lukens is the executive director of Historic Yellow Springs, a nonprofit group dedicated to preserving and restoring the land and buildings that grew up around the springs here in the Pickering Creek watershed. We walk around the grounds, where there are actually 3 separate springs, each with different mineral content. The iron-colored Yellow Spring gurgles in a gazebo. The Sulphur Spring, once used for bathing, is sheltered by what's now called the Jenny Lind Springhouse. The last discovered, in the mid-1800s, is the Magnesium Spring, now protected in the Crystal Diamond Springhouse, where Rob Lukens unlocks the door.
This is the one spring that is nice and clear and looks like you'd actually want to get into it. And this is the one that... It's called the Crystal Diamond Spring because of the, you see little bubbles that are coming up from the bottom of the spring, and they look like little diamonds that are sparkling in the water. This spring actually, for many, many years, supplied all the water for the entire village up until, I believe it was about the 1970s. And I just had a little taste the other day, not in here, but outside, and it still does taste really good, actually.
Back in the mid-1700s, entrepreneurs built a tavern and operated bathhouses, which drew visitors from as far as the West Indies. Archivist and former executive director Sandy Momeyer says that even a trip from Philadelphia could take a while, depending on the stops.
There were packet boats that came up the Schuylkill River, and at Norristown they could take a stagecoach, and they would come out through Norristown, Phoenixville, Kimberton, to the Yellow Springs here.
During the Revolutionary War, Yellow Springs became temporary headquarters for General Washington. And in 1778, the site of the nation's first military hospital, a large three-story structure with wraparound porches on the hillside above the wetlands. Although the building was destroyed by fire in 1962, we can visit the ruins and an herb garden growing herbs like those used in soldier care. This hospital, says Director Rob Lukens, was a critical factor in the war effort.
You really can't tell the story about the Revolutionary War in Chester County, the Revolutionary War in general, Valley Forge, without talking about this hospital, because this was the best medical facility, the first medical facility that served soldiers during the American Revolution.
After the war, the spa reopened, turned the hospital into additional lodging, and built shelters for the Springs. The fashionable resort attracted prominent statesmen like James Madison and Daniel Webster. With both health and recreational facilities, it had, says archivist Sandy Momeyer, something for everyone.
At one point, there were actually two separate hotels. One was supposed to be for those who were conscious of their health and wanted a quiet environment to heal. And the other place was promoted as a place where there was fine dining, wonderful spirits, fine dancing and music. So it was very, very social. So social to the fact that the local meeting house of Quakers in Euclid sent out a directive to all of their members and said that they were to keep their children away from the Yellow Springs Spa because promiscuous activity took place there. Then it meant card playing and dancing. And of course, I think we all have a different definition now.
Yellow Springs closed during the Civil War and afterwards was converted to one of eight boarding schools established by the Commonwealth to educate children left fatherless or orphaned. After the orphan school closed in 1912, education at Yellow Springs continued, but in a different form. Keeping pace with the Impressionist movement, Philadelphia's Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts purchased the property in 1916. Put in a bog garden, and converted the large 18th-century barn to a studio. Sally Ritter is the program director of the Chester Springs Studio, which continues the tradition of art education on the same site today.
The barn was used by the Academy for painting and drawing horses and sheep and goats. Now the upstairs section of the barn, where the horses were brought in for the Academy, is now our main painting studio. The downstairs part of the barn is our ceramic studio.
The Academy closed the school in the 1950s when the art world turned to abstract and non-representational art. But a new form of art took over at Yellow Springs. The filmmaker Shorty Yeaworth moved in, made the old hospital a studio, and turned the barn into a soundstage. His company produced Christian television and short films, as well as some full-length feature films, including one which would become a cult classic called The Blob, starring Steve McQueen. When the movie makers moved on in 1973, the 8-year-old Yellow Springs Association purchased the village, which was by then listed on the National Register of Historic Places. In 1976, historic Yellow Springs was born, or reborn, its mission to bring to life the richness of its past. After so many incarnations and reincarnations, what is the role of historic Yellow Springs today? Rob Lukens says that it is to protect, preserve, and somehow tell it all.
The amazing thing for me at Yellow Springs is that the history and the science, meaning the springs themselves and the environment, and the artistic heritage are all totally intertwined.
Historic Yellow Springs also hosts community events throughout the year. Its 33rd annual art show, with the works of over 170 juried artists, opens today and runs through May 14th.
Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis. More information on Historic Yellow Springs is available at the Culture Files section of gophila.com. After a more than 9-month-long search, the Philadelphia Orchestra last week announced the name of its new president. A Philadelphia native, James Underkoffler has been dean of the Eastman School of Music in Rochester since 1997. He replaces Joseph Kluger, who stepped down at the helm of the orchestra last August. Orchestra officials cite as reasons for Underkoffler's selection his knowledge and understanding of media and technology, his proven leadership and fundraising skills, and his strong musical and educational backgrounds. I spoke with James Underkoffler just before the official announcement of his appointment late last week. On the face of it, you're walking into an organization that's in pretty good shape. You have contracts with your musicians in place. You have a recording deal. You have a national radio deal. You have an endowment that's well on its way to being completed. What's left to do?
Well, this is an orchestra that's ready to go places, to really to redefine the orchestra in the 21st century. It's an enormous opportunity for me to help lead this process. We have a recording contract in place, but there are so many new technologies that need to be addressed, and that's an area that that I have an area of tremendous interest and expertise, I believe. Clearly, you know, we have a contract in place, but there's one to be, a new one to be negotiated this year. And if we're going to be looking at new ways of doing business and relating to our communities, we need to start addressing those in the contract talks.
What advantages do you feel you bring from academia, and what are the challenges you think you're going to face? Obviously, negotiating with musicians is going to be one of them.
Sure. What I bring, of course, is that I've worked with musicians my whole life, and I believe I know musicians, and I honor and respect them. I enjoy being with them. And that at the Eastman School, we've really been looking at how musicians will need to operate in the future and equipping them to do that. So I've been in touch with the innovations that are out there and also looking beyond. It's pretty obvious I haven't negotiated a musician's collective bargaining agreement, but in my past I've certainly done that with a teacher's union and I've managed that, so look forward to learning to do that.
There is a school of thought out there that says orchestras don't really need to engage with young people, that let them grow up and they'll eventually find their way to symphonic music, and we don't need to get into all these techno gadgets and bells and whistles to try and repackage what is actually a very, very good and very enduring product.
Well, I certainly don't agree with that at all. It's interesting to me because when I grew up, classical music was considered essentially the top of the pyramid. It was assumed that young people would gravitate to the top of that pyramid as they matured in their lives, and this just isn't so anymore. There's been a flattening of that pyramid, and there are so many musical genres available to people, and we've got to get in there. This is the most extraordinary music in the world, and we've got to get it in front of people and get young people involved. I want to see them walking down the street with their iPods tuned into the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Final question. This is something Maestro Eschenbach has covered many times, that he wants to try and get away from a certain element of the fear factor of coming into a concert hall, that you need to know how to behave. You need to come armed with a great deal of knowledge, and then you're sitting looking at these people in very formal clothing in a very formal setting that hasn't changed for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on changing the actual concert experience?
Well, I talked about this with the musicians and with the search committee, that we need to develop different presentational formats so that people become comfortable with the concert experience. But just commenting directly on what you just said, I found that even those people who are in the concert hall are very curious about what the music's all about. You know, they've learned how to dress up and right, and do the thing. But they're really interested. And so educational programs of different shapes and sizes, even for the veteran concert goer, are very popular.
James Underkoffler. He takes up his position as president and CEO of the Philadelphia Orchestra on August 1st. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Amy Bish, Catherine Johnson, Catherine Brown, Catherine Blodgett, and Megan Smedley. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.